Origins, Approaches and Debates in Psychology. Episode 5, The Biological Approach. The focus of this episode is the biological or biopsychological approach. The basic principles and assumptions of the biological approach are that we are the products of our brain structure, neurotransmission, the effects of neurotransmitters, the actions of hormones and pheromones, as well as our genetic inheritance. The influence of the biopsychological approach can be seen very clearly in the biological model of illness and disease and the concept of addiction, which is based on the addiction as disease model. This episode discusses the biological approach and psychology's early influences from physiology and medicine right through to modern brain scanning techniques. Could the bumps and outer contours of our skulls reflect the contours of our brain? Were these the beginnings of psychological measurements? Apart from philosophy, emerging findings from within physiology and medicine also significantly influenced what psychology has become in its modern form. The study of phrenology by Franz Josef Gall, 1758 to 1828, was a particularly popular early idea on the relationship between mental characteristics and the brain. The underlying assumption of phrenology was that the indentations and bumps on the outer surface of the skull reflected differences in brain volume that were associated with particular mental functions or personality traits. For example, a bump in one region might suggest that the individual was prone to aggressiveness, whereas indentation at another point in the skull might suggest a decreased capacity for conscientiousness or individuality. While this idea didn't stand up to rigorous scientific testing, the notion that certain parts of the brain are responsible for different mental abilities or traits was highly influential in stimulating further research. Developments in medicine that gave further credibility to the localization of function hypothesis came from the work of Paul Broca, 1824 to 1880, from France, and later Karl Wernicke, 1848 to 1905, in Germany. These physicians were looking at patients with brain damage to see how damage in particular regions of the brain related to different mental impairments. Using case studies, Paul Broca found that individuals with damage to the left frontal region of the brain could understand language, but were unable to produce speech of their own. This is called Broca's motor aphasia and can be remembered using the phrase, "If Broca's is broken, words can't be spoken." In contrast, Karl Wernicke found that if the damage was towards the rear region of the left-hand side of the brain, patients could speak fluently but had difficulties comprehending language, so their sentences were nonsensical. These findings provided more solid scientific evidence for the notion that mental functions, in this case language, could be broken down into distinct elements and localized to specific areas of the brain. This stimulated a vast array of subsequent investigations to further map the functions of the brain. Around this time, physiologists were beginning to take interest in different aspects of sensory perception. Researchers such as Ernst Weber, 1795 to 1878, were looking at two-point discrimination. Now, this was the investigation of how people perceive somatosensory or touch information in different regions of the body. Weber showed that our discrimination of two distinct points varied widely depending on how much we rely on touch information for that particular body part. You may already be aware that the tongue is about the most sensitive region of the body, and people in the tongue area could discriminate between two different points about 1 millimetre apart. The tips of your fingers and your toes are also very sensitive, and incidentally, that's why it hurts so much if you stub your finger or your toe, because there's a lot of sensory information coming from those points. Now, other places in the body, like the middle of the back or the middle of the thigh, actually had very poor ability to distinguish two stimuli. You could actually have two points separated by as much as 5 centimetres in the middle of the back, and the person would still perceive that as a single point. One of Weber's students, Gustav Fechner, 1801 to 1887, took the study of human response to physical stimuli further by investigating the ability to discriminate between other physical stimuli, such as 2 objects of different weights or 2 lights with different levels of brightness. One of the results of his observations, now known as Fechner's law, predicts that our ability to discriminate between 2 different stimuli decreases as the magnitude of the stimuli increases. To explain this, imagine you have 2 very bright lights. The difference in brightness between them will need to be large for you to detect the difference, whereas for 2 very dim lights, the difference in brightness only needs to be minimal for you to notice. This process of systematically investigating the relationships between physical stimuli and psychological perceptions became known as psychophysics. The psychophysics approach to quantifying sensory perception was fundamental in establishing the scientific method of inquiry into psychological phenomena. Researchers went on to investigate areas of the brain and found evidence for specialised functions building on the early work of Broca and Wernicke. The brain can be divided into 4 lobes called the frontal, parietal, occipital and temporal, all with their own areas of specialism. The frontal lobe is involved with motor skills and higher level cognitive functions, as well as motor behaviour through the motor cortex. Broca's area can be found in the left frontal lobe. The parietal lobe receives and processes all somatosensory input from the body, things like touch, temperature and pain. Wernicke's area is at the rear of the left parietal lobe. Our occipital lobe interprets visual information, whilst our temporal lobe is implicated in understanding language, as well as memory and emotion. So this is called localization of function. We haven't come close to understanding things like why some people are left-handed, whereas others are right-handed, and how this might affect brain lateralization structures. Or autism, which is sometimes called an extreme male brain condition and may reflect a brain localized in a different way to what we now call neurotypical brains. Although the brain has 2 hemispheres, left and right, these are connected by a dense network of fibers called the corpus callosum. Lateralization is the theory that the left and the right hemispheres are specialized to do different things. Generally speaking, the left hemisphere controls the right-hand side of the body and is specialised for language, whereas the right hemisphere controls the left-hand side of the body and is specialised for spatial tasks. The odd thing about the human body is that the way it's wired up, I mean, who would expect the left side to control the right and the right to control the left? Information from your left eye is actually going to the right hemisphere of your brain, and information from your right eye to the left hemisphere of the brain. Luckily, because these 2 hemispheres are connected by this dense network of communication wires, the corpus callosum, for most people, we're never aware of the different functions of the 2 hemispheres because they're constantly talking to each other. But what if the 2 hemispheres got separated? If we split the human brain into its 2 hemispheres, would we also split the person? In 1968, Roger Sperry investigated this with a small number of patients who had had surgery for severe epilepsy to sever the hemispheres of the brains by cutting the wires of the corpus callosum. This procedure is really drastic, but it has been shown to be effective for some patients suffering from very severe epilepsy. It has significantly reduced their seizures. Sperry then worked with a small number of these patients. He asked them to cover either their left eye, which you'll remember is linked to the right hemisphere, or their right eye, linked to the left hemisphere, and showed them various objects and asked them to recognise them by sight or name them. He found that patients could not name anything unless it had been received by the right eye left hemisphere connection, remembering that left goes for language. It's a good way to remembering it, L for left, L for language. And found that if information had been received by the left eye right hemisphere pathway, although they could match the object with their right hand, but not the left hand, they couldn't name it because it hadn't gone to the language hemisphere. Quite literally, the left hand did not know what the right hand was doing. Sperry suggested that one brain hemisphere actually then doesn't really know what the other hemisphere is doing, and further suggested that each hemisphere may have its own memories. To illustrate the need for most hemispheres in daily operation, consider the following joke with three possible punchlines, taken from Rita Carter's book, Mapping the Mind. Which one do you find funny? Once you've heard the joke and the punchlines, I'll explain what research has told us about how your left hemisphere alone would react and how your right hemisphere alone would react. Here's the joke. A kangaroo goes into a bar, sits down, and asks for a pint of beer. The bartender is astonished but gives the kangaroo its drink. The kangaroo says thank you and then asks how much the beer costs. The bartender decides to see how clever the kangaroo is, winks knowing to a customer before quoting an exorbitantly high price for the beer. The kangaroo pays the price, the bartender relaxes, feeling very superior, before commenting, "We don't get many kangaroos in here." Dot, dot, dot. Now here are three possible punchlines for this joke. A. Then the kangaroo gets out a gun and shoots the barman. B. Then the man on the next stool admits that he is a ventriloquist who has trained a kangaroo to sit on a stool and drink beer. C. Then the kangaroo replies, "I'm not surprised with beer at this price." Now, if you thought the best punchline was C, out of a bad bunch, I grant you, then the good news is that your two brain hemispheres have been happily chatting to each other across the corpus callosum. But what if only one hemisphere heard the joke? What would it find funny? What would it react to? The left-hand hemisphere on its own, dealing with language, is likely to prefer the literal explanation B, that the man is a ventriloquist who's trained the kangaroo to sit on a stool and drink beer while he provides a voice for it. So he's playing a joke on the barman. This is a literal explanation, and the left-hand hemisphere is likely to go for that. On the other hand, excuse the pun, the right hemisphere reacts to shock and surprise and is therefore likely to react to punchline A, the kangaroo gets out a gun and shoots the barman, because it involves an unexpected shock ending. You literally need both parts of your brain to put together the elements of the joke to find the punchline C, I'm not surprised with beer at this price, funny, or at least to be able to groan at how bad it is. So the brain has hemispheres and it has localized areas of specialism. What happens if an area of the brain is damaged, for example, in a stroke? Could we ever recover the lost functions? Brain plasticity is a concept that refers to changes in neural pathways which are due to changes in behavior, environment, and neural processes. Neuroplasticity has replaced the idea that the brain is a physiologically static organ, and research findings from people like Eleanor Maguire's 2000 study on London taxi drivers, who were studying from the knowledge, has added to this. She found that the volume of grey matter in the taxi drivers, who had to study hard for an intensive test called the knowledge about where London streets are connected. It's a very demanding thing to do. But she found that those taxi drivers' volume of grey matter in their anterior hippocampus, that's a part of the brain, was increased compared to non-taxi drivers. She concluded that the environmental demands can change the structure of your brain. Now, for students, that means that studying hard could literally lead to changes in your brain structure. And indeed, there are studies on medical students to show that thinking and studying hard really does, as Hercule Poirot would say, build up your little grey cells. Keeping mentally active has also been shown to be effective in protecting older people from the effects of dementia. Other researchers in this area have found that brain activity associated with a given function can also move to a different location in the process of recovery from an injury. Research also suggests that brain plasticity can be taken advantage of to help counteract the effects of aging. The counterargument to the brain being localized and lateralized was developed in 1950s by Carl Lashley. He investigated where in the brain our higher cognitive learning functions might lie by removing between 10% and 50% of the cortex in rats that were learning a maze. This type of research is highly unlikely to take place today, as there are much stricter guidelines on using animals in research. But in the 1950s, investigating the brain using invasive manipulations was an acceptable animal model. Lashley found that no specific area of the cortex was more important than any other in terms of the rat's ability to learn the maze. The process of learning the maze seemed to involve every part of the cortex rather than being confined to a particular area. This finding seems to suggest that learning is too complex to be localized and involves the requirement of the whole brain. Of course, Carl Lashley was using rats rather than humans, so we have to be careful about generalizing the findings. And of course, it would be totally unethical to remove parts of a living human being's cortex to try and find out. As well as brain structures, neurotransmitters play a role in the way we behave, and some play a role in mental illness. During your course, you'll come across a number of human neurotransmitters, including acetylcholine, which is involved in voluntary movement, learning, sleep, and memory. Dopamine, which is involved with movement, attention, and learning. Too much dopamine has been associated with schizophrenia, whilst too little dopamine is associated with a condition called Parkinson's disease. Serotonin is involved in mood, sleep, appetite, and impulsive and aggressive behaviour. Too little serotonin is associated with depression and obsessive-compulsive disorder. The endocrine system is connected to the nervous system via the hypothalamus, and these two systems work together to control the body's activities. The endocrine system consists of a set of glands that release chemical products called hormones into the bloodstream. The bloodstream then carries the hormones to all parts of the body. The endocrine hormones help control mood, growth, and development, the way our organs work, metabolism, and reproduction. Major glands and their hormones are the pituitary gland, which produces oxytocin, an adrenocorticotropic hormone, which then leads the adrenal glands to secrete cortisol. The pineal gland, which produces melatonin. The adrenal glands, which produce adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol for the stress fight or flight response. The pancreas, producing insulin. The ovaries, producing estrogen. The testes, producing testosterone, and last but definitely not least, the hypothalamus, which produces various hormones that stimulate the pituitary gland. Despite its small size, the pituitary gland is often called the master gland, and its role is to control many bodily processes. It senses the body's needs and sends signals all around the body to regulate its functions, controlling metabolism, growth, blood pressure, and many other vital physical functions and processes. And now a quick look into the role of hormones and pheromones in human behaviour. There is a difference between hormones and pheromones. You may have heard of hormones, you almost certainly, unless you do biology, haven't heard of pheromones. Hormones are internally secreted into your bloodstream by the endocrine system of glands. As I just mentioned, the pineal gland secretes melatonin, which plays a role in whether you feel sleepy or awake. Levels rise at night as light levels fall, and fall in the day as light levels rise. The pituitary gland secretes oxytocin, which plays a role in love and social bonding. Studies such as Michael Cosfeld et al. 2005 investigated the role of oxytocin in increasing trust in humans using 128 healthy male students, half of whom had oxytocin administered via a nasal spray before playing a trust game with real money stakes. They found that the level of trust between partners in the game was higher in those participants who had received the oxytocin compared to a control group who hadn't. Oxytocin plays an important role in parent-child bonding as well. And incidentally, even studies of dogs have shown that oxytocin led them to interact more with their owners and to spend more time in close proximity to them. The lesser-known pheromones are also produced by the human body but are excreted externally, a classic example being through our sweat. The function of pheromones is to carry chemical messages between members of the same species. Evidence for the influence of pheromones on humans has been inconclusive, with many interesting findings but a lack of clarity that's prevented us from making cause and effect conclusions. One of the most famous studies of pheromones and human behaviour was the Dirty Shirt study conducted by Klaus Wedekind and colleagues in 1995, investigating the role of major histocompatibility genes, which I'm going to call MHC genes from now on because it is a bit of a mouthful, on mate selection. There is good evidence that suggests that humans can detect a good genetic mate in MHC genes through pheromones, specifically through the smell of sweat. The researchers took 44 men and 49 women and asked the women to rate the attractiveness of men that they hadn't seen purely from their odour. They gave each woman the odour of 6 men, 3 that they'd classified as MHC similar, which is not genetically desirable in a mate. A good genetic mate has different range of genes to yours. And MHC dissimilar, therefore genetically desirable. They found that the women rated the MHC dissimilar sweats as more attractive. And that supports that hypothesis because remember, dissimilar means a wider range of genes means a better mate. But there was one notable exception. If the women were taking the contraceptive pill, which prevents pregnancy, they actually preferred the scent of the MHC similar men. Have a listen to the evolutionary psychology episode for much more on mating habits. This is called sexual selection. So, neuroscience, is it a scientific breakthrough or neurotrash? The modern biological approach explains how our behaviour is influenced by genetic, biochemistry, both neurotransmission, hormones and pheromones, and brain anatomy. The biological model is deterministic and assumes that behaviour is caused by nature rather than nurture. Biological psychologists use scientific research methods because they allow for tight control of variables, testable hypotheses, and for cause and effect relationships to be established. Biological psychologists also use methods such as twin and family studies, chemical manipulations, and brain scans. Modern brain scanning techniques have enabled researchers to investigate what's going on in our brains as it happens. Each brain scanning method has its own strengths and limitations. For example, some are very good at spatial resolution, which means they can pinpoint exactly where in the brain the activity is happening, whilst other methods are better at temporal resolution, and this refers to the time delay between something happening and it being recorded on screen. Brain scanning techniques covered in the course include functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, electroencephalograms, EEGs, and event-related potentials, ERPs, which measure brain responses as a direct result of a specific event. Claims to have identified various areas of the brain that underlie a range of human behaviours and cognitive processes using brain imaging, particularly functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, have produced some iconic images and a persuasive view of brain activity in real life. The areas that light up whilst a participant is engaged on some particular task, such as reading a book or reacting to pictures, are taken to be neural correlates of the behaviours or cognitions involved in the task. But is this a valid interpretation? Critics argue that we can't just look into the brain and see what it does, and that the lovely coloured images created are representations of areas of the brain that are working hardest, as measured by increased oxygen consumption. fMRI doesn't actually measure synaptic and neuronal activity, which occurs over the span of just milliseconds. It's actually measuring the oxygen changes, which take place over a span of seconds. So claims to have found centres that activate certain behaviours can't be taken literally. In the USA, criminal defence lawyers are increasingly drawing on neuroscientific findings to argue that their client's brain made them commit murder or some other violent act, an argument known as neurodeterminism. These type of arguments are central to the whole idea of criminal responsibility and whether we do, in fact, as humans, have free will. According to Val et al., 2009, the findings from many recent studies are virtually meaningless. 54% of the studies in their literature search had a seriously biased method of analysis. These studies had identified small areas of brain activity called voxels, 3D pixels about the size of a pea, comprising about 1 million neurons that varied according to the experimental condition of interest, without considering the role of random fluctuations. A good analogy for this would be the static or white noise that you hear on an untuned radio or TV station. The biological approach is undoubtedly reductionist. It attempts to explain human and non-human psychological processes and behaviour in terms of physical and physiological structures, such as the interaction between neurons, hormones, and pheromones. This does not reflect the experience and everyday interactions we have with other people. This approach tends to remove people from their social context, focusing almost exclusively on the physical processes within the body, which is a form of both reductionism and determinism. But outside of a laboratory environment, there is a limit to how far biological manipulation can take place to reveal a simple cause and effect relationship on our behaviour. Thank you for listening to the Origins, Approaches and Debates in Psychology podcast. It was written and presented by Mrs. Lawrence.